Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
From honest ignorance to dishonest ideology in science. Netan Shahar. At the northern tip of the autonomous region of Valencia, overlooking the Mediterranean Sea, lie the ruins of Sagunto, the most spectacular remains of Greco-Roman Hispania. In 218 BC, the Phoenicians of Carthage took the city after a long siege. It was from there that Hannibal launched the remarkable blitz which took him almost to the gates of Rome. We all know this, or at least we do once we've learned it, but when the celebrated Arab scientist Al-Udri saw the ruins around 1030, he was mystified. Who could have erected such colossal walls? Sagunto, he concluded, must have been created by gods or by giants. Al-Udri, one of our chief sources on medieval Iberia, did not know about the Romans. Perhaps he had heard of them, but he didn't understand that his country had been part of their empire, and without the necessary prior knowledge, he had no way of connecting those Romans to the extraordinary evidence before his eyes. Therein lies one major difference between the scholars of our time and those of the medieval period, that they had such a limited perspective looking backwards. An expert often did not know all there was to know, even in his own field. Muslim scientists admired Aristotle, but their knowledge infrastructure was meagre compared to that of the ancient Greeks. Aristotle knew all there was to know in the several fields in which he was a leading light. In that respect, he was like today's specialists. As soon as anything new happens in their field, they'll hear about it. In 1143, the Englishman Robert of Ketton made the first translation of the Quran into Latin. But 70 years later, when Mark of Toledo set to work on his translation of the book, he had not heard of Robert of Ketton's work and believed himself to be a pioneer. Shortly before Al-Udri's time, there had been a marvellous state library in Umayyad Cordoba, but in his time it was destroyed and scattered. Books were expensive and their owners rarely let them out of their homes. Often those who most needed to see a book didn't know it existed or where to find it. Of course, there were people alive in 1030 who knew about the Romans in Spain. The Christian priests in Syria knew, some rabbis surely knew, and others, but Al-Udri didn't know, and it is hard to blame him. Back then, when you didn't know something, you often went on not knowing it, unlike today, when we can gauge our ignorance in an instant with the push of a button. Al-Udri's cluelessness about Sagunto is an instance of what Donald Rumsfeld famously called unknown unknowns. Rumsfeld, then US Secretary of Defense, was trying to account for US disappointments during the Iraq War. That wasn't the first time unknown unknowns have decided wars and changed history. In 1798, when French forces landed in Egypt, the local Mamluk generals were not only ignorant about light field guns, they barely knew what France was or where it was located. In science, unknown unknowns are often related to heroic feats. We admire Gregor Mendel for discovering the basic laws about heredity without knowing about genes. And we admire Darwin even more for turning out his theory of evolution without an understanding either of heredity or of genes. Aristarchus of Samos, without telescopes, proposed Copernicus's theory that the Earth revolved around the Sun and not the other way about, some 1,700 years before Copernicus. Ignaz Semmelweis, the Hungarian doctor, by a series of brilliant deductions, accounted for the work of bacteria decades before the germ theory of disease had been established by Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur. The germ theory was first proposed by another lonely genius, the Veronese polymath Girolamo Fracastoro, in 1546, but met with scorn. Honest ignorance is different from pretending to know. Al-Udri didn't lie when he suggested that Sagunto was built by aliens. He made a wild guess. Cold-blooded lying in science is different. For example, the city of Madrid has an Arab name and was founded by an Arab king. Many Christians were unhappy about that, including the 17th century historian Jerónimo de Quintana. In order to purge his city of any Muslim associations, he constructed a proof that Madrid had in fact been founded by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. This didn't sound as strange then as it does today. At the time, it was believed that Lisbon had been founded by Ulysses and that Hercules was the begetter of Seville. In 17th century Sweden, the scientist Olof Rudbeck came up with a proof that Sweden was the lost continent of Atlantis and that paradise was located near his office at the University of Uppsala. The Swedes were really the descendants of Noah from the Book of Genesis. All knowledge, all virtue, and all of the arts were Swedish gifts to humanity. Something similar happened in our time when Mustafa Kemal Ataturk ordered his scientists to prove that all the great peoples who had left their glorious ruins in Turkey, including the Greeks, had in reality been Turks. While growing up in the last century, most of us gained the impression that science had, for much of history, been steered by superstition and bullied by clerics. But that things had improved since then, and that scientific mission was now a much more serious enterprise. We soon realized things were neither that idyllic nor that simple. The sheer volume of knowledge and the access to that knowledge have exploded, but the ethics of science has not soared in any corresponding way. There are theories and claims today in sociology, in psychiatry, in gender and post-colonial studies that are every bit as unserious as astrology or the reading of tea leaves. Some of these ideas, such as the theory of recovered memories, have remained dominant in the public sphere long after they were refuted scientifically. There is no linear moral progress in knowledge and science. There are highs and lows. Compared to charlatans like Quintana or Rudbeck, whose motives and methods were disgraceful, the scientists of medieval Cordoba were models of rigor and intellectual honesty. Around 1130, two remarkable thinkers were born in Cordoba, only a few years apart. The Muslim Muhammad ibn Rushd, known by Westerners as Averroes, and the Jew Moshe ben Maimon, known to us as Maimonides. They both spent their lives doing the same thing, reconciling their religion with scientific method, which then meant Greek logic and empirical research. When the Holy Scripture collided with reason, Averroes and Maimonides did not tweak the logic or tamper with the evidence. Instead, they demanded and carried out a reinterpretation of religion. Averroes advised, "Those sections of the Quran which appear to be contrary to evidence or to logical reason should be reinterpreted." You will not find many Muslims prepared to say that publicly today, yet Averroes was a qadi, a judge at the Sharia court. When the thoughts of Averroes and Maimonides reached the Christians of the late Middle Ages, the urgency to bring faith into line with science became a Christian concern and one of the impulses behind the first universities. The Jews and the Muslims in southern Iberia were onto something big, but then everything changed. The tolerant culture where Averroes and Maimonides had been able to study logic and science was destroyed by a fanatical jihadi sect from Africa, the Al-Muwahidun, or Almohads. Northern, Christian, Spain became the new center of Jewish learning. But it was not the rational Judaism of Maimonides, but a mystical, superstitious Jewish philosophy not based on the study of nature, but on magic and obscure numerological calculations, what we now know as the Kabbalah. The central work of the Kabbalah, the Zohar, was written in Aramaic in the town of Guadalajara, a small town outside Madrid, around the year 1300, by a local rabbi. We must not, although many do, blame all the hardships of science on the church and religion. Organized religion often feels threatened by science, but it doesn't always attack it. Giordano Bruno was murdered by the church, and Galileo Galilei was silenced. But a century earlier, Copernicus had been praised by the Pope Clement VII for the very same theory that got Bruno and Galilei into trouble. Secularization has been liberating, especially in countries like Sweden, where writers were put on trial as late as the 1890s for mentioning sex or joking about Christ. We all know how Galilei was humiliated before the Inquisition, but few know what really happened to Ignaz Semmelweis. Many have heard of his brilliant way of bringing down the numbers of deaths from childbirth fever at the General Hospital in Vienna. He realized that doctors and students coming from performing autopsies in the morgue to the maternity ward somehow contaminated the new mothers. Semmelweis made them wash their hands and instantly brought down the fatality rate. This was in the 1840s, a generation before Koch and Pasteur proved the role of bacteria in the spread of disease. Semmelweis couldn't justify his conclusion biologically, but he was correct, and his method worked. You would have expected every colleague and maternity ward to pick up on this breakthrough immediately and save lives. But no, they all attacked Semmelweis, not only his envious colleagues in Vienna, but the foremost professors of London and Paris all ganged up, called him a crank, and wrote treatises denouncing him. Those were scientists. In the end, Semmelweis was taken to a madhouse, where he died soon afterwards, following mistreatment at the hands of the guards. The experts all went on not washing their hands for another 20 years. There are similar cases today in psychiatry, where entire healthcare systems have adopted theories with no empirical evidence at all, such as the theory of mental ailments being caused by genetically conditioned chemical imbalances in the synapses of nerve cells. Science, like capitalism and democracy, is not a natural state. Like them, it is a hyper-vulnerable, rare equilibrium requiring constant protection and courage. As the Swedish philosopher Benjamin Höje put it, "Seek the truth. If truth brings you to the gates of hell, knock on those gates." Höje, in the early 19th century, was persecuted by the state and could not make a living. Two centuries later, his university at Uppsala still prefers fashionable ideology to reality and truth. Some years ago, the theologian Eva Lundgren, a professor of sociology and a gender theory feminist, claimed that large numbers of children had been murdered in Swedish forests by devil worshippers. There were no missing children, and the professor provided no names, dates, or locations. But many of her colleagues and a majority of opinion makers supported her. Professor Lundgren was disgraced after large-scale fraud in her research was revealed. There was a storm, but eventually the university sided with her, apologized for ever having doubted her results, and granted her many millions of kroners to be spent on further investigations of male structural violence. You would be excused for assuming that the Lundgren case was the low watermark of Swedish anti-science, but you would be wrong. In the early 1990s, at a mental asylum in Säter in central Sweden, a petty criminal called Thomas Kvik was subjected to recovered memory therapy. Kvik, who was smarter and a better judge of character than his psychiatric minders, soon realized that any recovered memories he produced during therapy caused euphoria among the staff and resulted in favors and privileges for him. The more salacious and violent his revelations, the better the drugs and the longer the leaves were for Kvik. He laid it on thicker and thicker until he told them that his baby brother had been ritually murdered and eaten by the family. That was a hard story to beat. In order to top it, he began to confess to murders. While away on leave from the asylum, he scoured old newspaper archives for unsolved murder cases, to which he then confessed. He admitted having killed more than 30 people and was found guilty of 8 murders. Kvik could not show the remains of any of his victims. He could not lead investigators to the crime scenes. There was no evidence, there were no witnesses, and no discovery of murder weapons. Nevertheless, the criminal justice system, the police, the courts, most psychiatric experts, and most of the media were happily duped. Recovered memory therapy was celebrated as the cutting edge of science, and the very few experts who swore that Kvik was a mythomaniac were ignored or vilified. The epitome of this collective madness was reached when forensic doctors certified that a piece of wood was a splinter of bone from one of Kvik's victims. The state, the police, the courts, and the psychiatrists would happily have carried on, convicting Kvik of whatever he confessed to. The ideological feeding frenzy was not stopped by anyone involved, but by two courageous freelance journalists, Hannes Rostam and Don Josefsson, who exposed the truth in 2 books. In order for them to reach the wider public, they were forced to publish their findings in book form because the mainstream media were so reluctant to elucidate the issue from any other angle than that of the consensus. Kvik was a mass murderer, and recovered memory therapy was an unequivocal blessing. These were not merely empirical claims, but axioms. Such cases of irrational hysteria used to be the study objects of experts in the psychology of religion. But since the arrival of postmodernism and relativism, the truth criteria of many academic fields have less and less to do with research and more to do with the preferred opinions of believers. The philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein famously said about psychoanalysis that its only truth criterion was the patient's readiness to accept it. Weirdly, much of this cultish superstition goes under the name of theory, or even critical theory, even though its proponents deny or ignore the most elementary requirements of scientific theory. Faculties, which were once models of sobriety and empirical research, are today hotbeds of the most egregious nonsense. News items reporting mob attacks, in several cases near lynchings, against controversial visiting lecturers at American universities, are no longer headline events. Teachers have lost tenure after daring to challenge articles of multicultural faith. This happens more often at Ivy League and prestigious institutions than it does in regional seats of learning. When ideological firestorms break out, the management of the schools usually prefers to appease the zealots rather than defending freedom of expression, pluralism, and the other core values they advertise in their marketing. Any scholar or researcher who studies or even speaks about biologically determined differences between the sexes will get into trouble. The Swedish neuroscientist, Jermund Hesloff, long a bête noire of the gender-righteous lobby, was denounced by students at the University of Lund in September 2018 for saying, during a lecture, that some differences between men and women were biological. Instead of rushing to his defence, the university, ominously, declared that it had opened an investigation. This, apparently, is the future. The Enlightenment may not be over yet, but its position in our seats of learning is no longer self-evident, but, increasingly, a controversial minority position.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Bokförlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.